This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 3 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, the Dutch elections delivered a blow to the far-right Freedom Party leader Geert Wilders, who failed to achieve the success that some had expected, bringing some comfort to those who feared a shift in European politics toward right-wing populism. With the Dutch elections over, all eyes are on France, where voters go to the polls in a few short weeks. But with Republican candidate François Fillon now under a formal fraud investigation, are traditional right-wing voters likely to gravitate to the far-right Marine Le Pen? Will EU supporting Scottish voters who backed a no vote in the 2014 Scottish independence referendum help secure a future yes vote if a second independence referendum is held in Scotland? Given that 62% of Scots have voted to remain within the European Union in the UK-wide poll held last June. And how did one Canadian pub manage to annoy an entire nation? All of that and more over the next hour on this Thursday edition of World in Focus. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte suffered a loss of 8 seats in yesterday's general election, but managed to see off a challenge from the far-right Freedom Party. The news will bring comfort to many who feared that the vote might have presented a symbolic shift in European politics towards right-wing populism and Euroscepticism. Jack Foster has more.
Yesterday, all eyes were on the Netherlands as they took to the polls for a general election. It was billed as the epicentre of a tinderbox of right-wing populism, the next domino to fall in a sequence beginning with the reactionary positions taken by the likes of Hungary in the wake of Europe's refugee crisis, the Brexit vote in Britain, Austria's near-miss presidential election last year, and the looming threat of a Marine Le Pen victory in France this year. But might the media hysteria over the Netherlands' much-hyped lurch towards the far right have been overplayed? And might the subsequent failure of Geert Wilders' Freedom Party to break through be overshadowing the real story of yesterday's Dutch elections? Let's firstly look at the results as they stand, with around 95% of the votes counted. The clear winners of the night were Prime Minister Mark Rutte's People's Party for Freedom and Democracy, or VVD, who have been leading a coalition government in the Netherlands in one form or another since 2006. But it was simultaneously a pretty major blow for the VVD, losing as they did 8 seats. Not that you'd have got that sense from Mark Rutte, who was buoyed by the fact that far-right PVV leader Geert Wilders, despite an increase in support, came in some 13 seats behind the VVD.
I think it means in the Netherlands that people have been responsive to two messages. In the first place, that we should not experiment, that we should continue the policies of recovery to make this economy stronger, and now to make people feel in their personal lives that this economy is one of the best performing economies in the Western world. People have said no to another country where the domino stone of the wrong side of populism will topple over.
Prime Minister of the Netherlands and leader of the VVD party, Mark Rutte, speaking during the early hours of this morning to members of the press. Obviously, spirits were high and celebrations were in progress, hence the noise in the background. So those were the headline results in yesterday's Dutch elections. But Mark Rutte and Geert Wilders' parties only accounted for 34% of the vote between them. And let's make no bones about it, the PVV will not be a part of any coalition negotiations. But neither will the Labour Party, who suffered a defeat of historic proportions. The party, which was a coalition partner in government with 38 seats in the House of Representatives, was decimated, down 29 seats to just 9. Perhaps, though, the most underreported story of the night was the surge in support for smaller, left-of-centre, pro-European parties, such as D66, which were up 7 seats, and the Greens up 10 seats. Even the PVDD, that's the Animal Protection Party, gained 3 seats. Earlier, I spoke with Dr. Hans Vollard from the Department of Political Science at Leiden University, and I asked him, firstly, why Geert Wilders' Freedom Party didn't break through as many had expected.
Well, the populist anti-Islam and anti-EU Freedom Party did not as well as we expected according to the opinion polls. And that might have to do with the fact that Geert Wilders, the leader of the Freedom Party, didn't take an active role in the election campaign apart from his occasional tweet. Mm. Only in the last few days of the election campaign, he participated in televised debates with other third party leaders, which are crucial because of the huge number of voters hesitating until the very last moment what to vote for. But it seems as if, because of his, well, limited activity in the election campaign, he didn't gain as many seats as expected.
The PVV gained 5 points, and yes, they came in second. But I wonder, should the attention today maybe not be focused on what in reality could certainly be argued as a surge on the left? The biggest gains of the night were, after all, made by Jesse Clever's Greens, Alexander Pechtold's D66, both centre-left, both pro-European. This doesn't really paint a picture of a country sliding towards right-wing Eurosceptic populism.
Well, the elections result clearly shows that the Netherlands, that the Dutch voters, are divided on issues of migration and integration, and also divided on issues of European integration. A majority of the voters and a large majority of the parties are really against Nexit, of the Netherlands leaving the European Union. Mm. But nevertheless, there's quite a divide between those parties such as D66 and the Green Left Party in favor of more European integration, and parties such as the Freedom Party, the Socialist Party to some extent, which are against more power for Brussels. And there's also a clear divide on cultural issues, with pro-cultural diversity parties such as Green Left and D66 making quite some gains, and together also larger than the anti-Islam and anti-EU party. But I wouldn't say anything about a surge of the left because of the huge gains of the Green Left Party, because we have seen a dramatic loss for the Labour Party. Mm. We have never seen such a loss before for a party in Dutch parliamentary history. It lost almost 30 seats, which is really dramatic.
One thing we will have learned from last night is that the government, as it was, did not do well. Mark Rutte's party dropped 8 points. Worth noting that their lead was as a result of quite a sudden surge in 2012 as well, though. But as you mentioned there, the Labour Party, which was by far the worst result of the night, with 29 or 30 points that they had dropped. Is that purely the price of having governed in coalition with Mark Rutte's party, or is there more going on here?
Well, the Labour Party can no longer rely on a loyal group of voters as it could do, let's say, 20, 30 years ago. But the Labour Party also lost because it cooperated with one of its main opponents on socio-economic issues, the fiscal conservative VVD party, and it has been responsible for major reforms and also cuts in the healthcare, in the welfare state, and particularly people above 50 feel much more uncertain about their economic future, about the economic prospects. And that has translated in a dramatic loss for the Labour Party, and quite some gains for main competitors such as the Green Left Party and also the D66 Party. But what played a role too is that in 2012, in the last parliamentary elections in the Netherlands, economic issues were more important, according to the voters, than in the present elections. And so at that time, more voters found it important to support the Labour Party to defend their interests, whereas now the focus has been more on defending Dutch culture. So that might also explain a certain shift to right-wing parties, or sufficiently parties at least defending Dutch culture, such as the Freedom Party.
Just before we go, and I suppose you have touched on it there in what you were saying, but and it's obviously very early, obviously it's still just hours since the results have been counted, and there's possibly still some technically to be counted. Is there a sense at this stage of where those Labour votes went? I mean, and did they go in one direction, or was it spread?
Well, yes, indeed, we should be cautious to indicate where the votes for the Labour Party went. But my hunch would be that part of the Labour Party voters stayed at home, whereas others shifted to the Green Left Party and to the Social Liberal D66 Party.
Dr. Hans Vollard, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
Dr. Hans Vollard there from the Department of Political Science at Leiden University, talking to us earlier about yesterday's general election in the Netherlands. And so much of Europe, at least progressive pro-EU Europe, will be breathing a sigh of relief today as that populist domino was prevented from falling. But pragmatists will also be looking at the fact that the far right in the Netherlands have made gains, albeit more modest than expected. The psychological impact that will have on the likes of Marine Le Pen, who was hoping to ride that populist wave all the way to the French presidency this year, remains to be seen. But for now, it seems that the tide of right-wing populism may not be encroaching on Europe quite as fast as observers had once feared. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
And Jack Foster joins me in the studio now. A long night following all of this for you, Jack, last night, I imagine.
I checked it in the morning, I'll be honest with you, Carolyn. I didn't do an all-nighter on this one.
How big of a threat was Geert Wilders and the Freedom Party in reality?
Well, firstly, congratulations on your pronunciation there, Carolyn.
I know earlier.
You were practicing it throughout that report. As you will remember, about a couple of weeks ago, we did a piece on this very show, in this very studio, and we were talking about the proposed threat from Geert Wilders' Freedom Party. And, well, what I was saying then was kind of what ended up happening, which was really that they weren't going to be the threat that everyone was painting them as. It was largely symbolic of this shift to the far right and populism in Europe. And I think that was more of the worry, was that if they led the polls, then they wouldn't have had the numbers to be able to make a government. No one was going to work with them. They could have won. I mean, you have to remember that the winning party, the Party for Freedom and Democracy, Mark Rutte's party, only won with 21.3% of the vote. It's not a massive share, but obviously they'll be able to work with other parties and they'll be able to form a coalition. Geert Wilders would not have been able to have done that. So, but if he had come first, then the symbolism for the likes of Marine Le Pen, for the likes of Brexiters in the UK, for the likes of Donald Trump in America, would have probably been quite great.
Mm-hmm. Now, the defeat suffered by the Labour Party was pretty massive, and obviously you talked about it in that report there, but I wonder if we could maybe unpack it a little further. What happened?
Well, allow me to use an analogy, Carolyn, which will probably make more sense for listeners in the United Kingdom, but anyone who has been following politics in the United Kingdom over the past few years will be familiar with the downfall of the Liberal Democrats. Once quite a popular party in the UK, they were the third largest party at UK level. They were very big in Scotland as well, throughout the UK. But what happened was in 2010, if you remember, the Conservatives won minority government and went into coalition with the Liberal Democrats. And the Liberal Democrats are very much a left-of-centre party. They're not in line with Conservatives' ideas on economics and so on at all. And as a result of spending 4 years in coalition with the Conservatives, they were decimated at the last general election in the UK. That's the analogy, because that's effectively what happened with the Labour Party in the Netherlands. They have been in a coalition with the Freedom and Democracy Party, Mark Rutte's party, since the last election in 2012. And again, they are economically, fiscally quite opposed. And in terms of their support base, I think a lot of people were rather annoyed by that and weren't willing to let them back in. And yes, it was a massive defeat. It was 29 seats that they lost, and that was by far the biggest defeat of the night.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting. Thank you very much for that, Jack Foster.
Are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, with the Dutch elections over, all eyes are on France, where voters go to the polls in a few short weeks. But with Republican candidate Francois Fillon now under a formal fraud investigation, are traditional right-wing voters likely to gravitate toward the far-right Marine Le Pen? We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war. Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
On Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not you're saying everybody's doubling down. They're crazy.
They are. Everyone's crazy.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
After decades of Western regime change in the Middle East, a line has been drawn in Syria, though at enormous human cost. On the sixth anniversary of the start of this conflict, I sit down with Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos to survey the wreckage of Western foreign policy and look at the reality of Trump's presidency and his stance towards Syria and the conflict after 4 months in office. Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme. With the Dutch elections over, all eyes are on France, where voters go to the polls in just a few short weeks. But with Republican candidate François Fillon now under a formal fraud investigation, are traditional right-wing voters likely to gravitate toward the far-right Marine Le Pen? Will EU supporting Scottish voters who backed a no vote in the 2014 Scottish independence referendum help secure a future yes vote if a second referendum is held in Scotland, given that 62% of Scots voted to remain within the European Union in a UK-wide poll held last June? And how did one Canadian pub manage to annoy an entire nation? You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 19 minutes past the hour. As campaigning ramps up as we edge ever closer to the French presidential elections, the scandal-ridden Republican candidate François Fillon is still standing by his assertions of innocence. This week, Fillon was placed under formal investigation, putting him one step closer to trial, with the charges covering suspicion of embezzling public funds, complicity in misappropriating funds, receiving the funds and not declaring assets fully, according to a judicial source. Fillon has refused to pull out of the race, and in under 6 weeks, voters will go to the polls to decide his fate. Yesterday, I spoke to Gilles Valdé, a researcher in political science with the National Centre for Scientific Research based at the University of Nice. I asked him if Fillon was likely to change his stance now that he is formally under investigation.
No, because he was expecting the decision from the judges. He knew that he would be placed under formal investigation a few days ago, so he knew what would happen. So no, that won't change anything.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of, you know, have you seen cases like this in France in the past of the misuse of funds? Is this something that's come up before?
Well, we've seen that before, of course, but never in the course of the election and never for the presidential election and at that stage during the campaign. So this is clearly a historical first.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Fillon is in a bit of a tricky situation, given that his comments when he was a candidate still at the primaries were that no presidential candidate should be embroiled in such a scandal. Is he not looking a little bit hypocritical right now?
Oh, yeah, he does. And as you may have noticed, French voters have realized that too, because his support has been dropping quite substantially in polls now. He was clearly the leader in the French election. He was set to win the presidential, and now he's trailing in third place, maybe fourth. So clearly his chances of winning are slim, and that's definitely a consequence of the scandal.
Mm-hmm. And the Republican Party, I mean, they're trying to put a strong face on this and to state that they're behind Fillon, but there must be a lot of internal arguments going on here with people wanting to replace him. Do you think that we're not seeing that in the public so much, but perhaps that there is a lot of chat going on behind the doors of the Republican Party?
No, I think the calculation, yeah, you're right. There were lots of disagreement, and some people left the campaign and came back. The centrist partners, the other parties, they've left the campaign and got back into it. So, yeah, lots of disagreement and anger within the Fillon camp. But I think the calculation is that at the moment, there is a core right-wing electorate which still supports Fillon. So they expect that this core electorate will turn out in mass in April and help Fillon win the election, in which case the scandal would sort of fade away maybe in the future. But right now, yeah, there's a lot of anger within the French right, and clearly if Fillon loses the election, which is something we might anticipate, then probably there'll be trouble within the party in the future.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the one person that seems to be benefiting from this is the centrist candidate Macron. Now, is there any indication that he might try and reach out to those more right-wing voters that would traditionally vote for Fillon? Is there any chance that he might maybe adopt some policies that would appeal to those voters?
Well, he has. I mean, he has a liberal agenda, more market liberal agenda on the economic side of things. So I think he's reached out to those voters. But right now, he knows that those who still support Fillon, they are very much right-wing conservative voters, the traditional ones. So these ones, they won't defect to Macron, who is far too left for them. If some of those defect, they'll probably go to the extreme right, to Marine Le Pen, but it's unlikely they will turn to Macron because he's far too liberal and especially culturally liberal for those voters who are very socially conservative. They have very socially conservative views.
If a voter was to abandon Fillon because of these scandals, and you're saying they could potentially go to Le Pen, is she not also embroiled in several scandals that may put off voters?
Yeah, but right now what we see is that for some reasons she's been playing this sort of I'm victim of the system card, you know, because the FN has never been quite part of the political system, never really was in government. So it seems to be still working. Obviously, there'll be consequences in the future, but right now it seems that voters are so angry with the rest of the politicians in France that they see, they see Marine Le Pen as the lesser of two evils.
And just one last thing, is there a chance that perhaps instead of being forced to vote for Le Pen in the absence of having the support for Fillon, do you think that this might just make a lot of people disengage and not bother voting?
Well, right now what we see is that in polls, the expected turnout is quite low for a presidential. So you might, maybe you're right, maybe some of those voters will abstain from voting because they are so dissatisfied with the Fillon candidacy. But at the same time, the Fillon voters are among the oldest ones. So these are the ones that do turn out quite massively, usually in French politics. So it's unlikely that they will stay home and say, well, we're not going to vote for him. So I think in the end, Fillon should be able to mobilize his core support in the election. The problem is that he will need other voters from the more centrist sectors of the electorate, and he won't get those because those are very, very angry because of the scandal, and that's part of the equation for Fillon.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your time today. It's a pleasure having you on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, will EU supporting Scottish voters who backed a no vote in the 2014 Scottish independence referendum help secure a future yes vote if a second referendum is held in Scotland, given that 62% of Scots voted to remain within the European Union in the UK-wide poll held last June? We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
We'll do one together. You ready? Are you ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hi, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and...
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to question to worry him. Give him one, better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman program.
Oddly enough, it's not non-fiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come in today's programme, could EU-supporting Scottish voters who voted against independence in the 2014 Scottish independence referendum help secure a future yes vote if a second referendum is held in Scotland, given that 62% of Scots voted to remain within the European Union in last June's EU referendum? And how did one Canadian pub manage to annoy an entire nation? In 2014, it was described as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but less than 3 years on, and the Scottish Government is pressing hard for a second chance to secure independence for Scotland. The UK-wide EU referendum changed things, with a majority in Scotland voting to remain within the EU and a narrow majority across the rest of the UK backing Brexit. Our reporter Mark Hurst has been exploring whether the Brexit result will persuade pro-EU but previously anti-Scottish independence voters to back a breakaway from the UK next time around.
The announcement this week by Nicola Sturgeon, the Scottish First Minister, calling for a second Scottish independence referendum, appeared to wrong-foot the UK government as they prepare to trigger Article 50, the mechanism that will formally signal the UK's exit from the EU. But with opinion polls in Scotland showing support for independence remaining broadly static since the country held a breakaway referendum from the UK in 2014, what realistic prospect is there that a majority yes vote might be secured just 3 years after 55% of people in Scotland voted to remain part of Britain? Before 2014's independence referendum, the ruling pro-independence Scottish National Party repeatedly told voters the independence referendum would be, quotes, a once-in-a-generation event. It became a mantra repeated by both the former SNP leader and Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond and also by his then-deputy Nicola Sturgeon.
Well, I mean, I think the SNP have always said that, in our view, these kind of referendums are once-in-a-generation events. This is probably a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Scotland, and I hope we seize that opportunity to bring powers home so that we can create the kind of country we want to be and continue to have a fantastic relationship with our friends, neighbours, family in other parts of the British Isles.
Nicola Sturgeon there, speaking before 2014's Scottish independence referendum. But last year's Brexit vote that will see the UK leave the European Union appears to have altered the SNP's understanding of what a generation or once-in-a-lifetime opportunity means. At a press conference on Monday, Sturgeon unveiled her plans for a second referendum.
I will now take the steps necessary to make sure that Scotland will have a choice at the end of this process. A choice of whether to follow the UK to a hard Brexit or to become an independent country, able to secure a real partnership of equals with the rest of the UK and our own relationship with Europe.
62% of Scottish voters voted to remain within the EU following the 2016 EU referendum on UK membership of the European trading bloc. And it was in this context that Sturgeon went on to set out what she believes constitutes the SNP's fresh mandate to call for a second referendum on Scottish independence, that she hopes will retain Scotland's place within the EU. Next week she will seek a Section 30 order, a legislative mechanism that will allow the Scottish Parliament to formally request the UK government grant a second independence referendum.
The Scottish Government's mandate for offering this choice is beyond doubt. Last year, we were elected with the highest share of the constituency vote won by any party in the history of devolution on a manifesto that said this: the Scottish Parliament should have the right to hold another referendum if there is a significant and material change in the circumstances that prevailed in 2014, such as Scotland being taken out of the EU against our will. These conditions have, of course, now been met. So I can confirm today that next week I will seek the authority of the Scottish Parliament to agree with the UK Government the details of a Section 30 order. the procedure that will enable the Scottish Parliament to legislate for an independence referendum.
But with UK government ministers already ruling out the prospect of granting a second Scottish referendum before Brexit is complete, what realistic chance does Scotland have of becoming independent in either the near future or even in the next generation? Earlier I spoke with Dennis Canavan. Mr Canavan is the former chairman of the official Scottish independence campaign known as Yes Scotland and a former Labour MP and independent MSP at the Scottish Parliament. Now Dennis Canavan, levels of support for Scottish independence are higher now than they were before the 2014 campaign began, but it's still going to be a significant task to secure a yes vote. Has the yes campaign fully understood the reasons why it didn't win the last time, and is it likely to take a significantly different tack next time round?
Well, it's worth recalling that the start of the last campaign in 2012, support for independence was hovering at about 28 or 29%, and by the time the referendum day came round, we'd increased it to 45%. Not enough to ensure victory, but nevertheless, a very, very significant increase in the number of people voting for independence. On things like currency, we were in a weak position, especially when the UK government and the official opposition at Westminster ruled out any possibility of a currency union with sterling. So obviously we've got to work hard on currency to get a consistent message and a credible message across. Another reason was I think there was too much emphasis on oil revenues, and again some work is being done on that through the Growth Commission and other think tanks. And another apparent weakness, ironically, was our membership of the European Union. It's rather ironic that many people in 2014 believed the claim that only a no vote would guarantee membership of the European Union.
And will support for continued EU membership among previous no voters prove enough to persuade a majority to vote yes next time?
Many people who voted no to independence in 2014 then voted to remain in the European Union last year. Many of these people will switch to vote yes to independence because they feel that Scotland is, as I said, on the verge of being kicked out of the European Union against their will. But those converts, I admit, these converts will be very welcome, but they may not be sufficient to ensure a yes result next time round. So we must work harder than ever to convince people of the democratic advantages and consequently the social and economic advantages of Scotland becoming independent, because an independent Scotland would mean a fairer, more equal society with full membership of the international community.
And what prospect is there that the pro-union side will adopt a more positive tone during the next Scottish independence referendum campaign?
Very little prospect. I mean, I think we're going to see Project Fear resurrected yet again. The entire British establishment will use every dirty trick in the book to unite to try to terrify people into voting no to independence. But I am confident that if we work hard at it, then hope will triumph over fear.
And during the EU referendum in 2016, EU nationals living in the UK were barred from voting. If that same voting criteria had been applied for the last Scottish independence referendum of only allowing people born in Scotland to vote in the referendum, then in 2014 there would have been a majority yes vote by a margin, coincidentally, of 52%, which is the same margin that Leave campaigners secured in 2016. Given that precedent set by the UK government in 2016, should the next Scottish independence referendum be decided only by those born in Scotland, and would that necessarily guarantee a yes vote?
My answer to your first question is no. I think it would be wrong to exclude people from voting simply because they were not born in Scotland. I think that if people have come to Scotland to live and work and make their homes here, that should entitle them to vote. And I am confident that most of those people will vote yes on the grounds that an independent Scotland would welcome immigrants because we need to increase our working population. The majority of immigrants who come to Scotland make a very, very valuable contribution to Scottish society.
And the UK government looks set to rule out any possibility of a second Scottish independence vote before Brexit has been completed. Might that strategy backfire on the Conservatives?
Yes, it would backfire. I think that if Theresa May continues with her intransigence, then that will encourage more Scots to vote yes to independence in the forthcoming referendum.
In the Scottish White Paper, when it was published, and the previous Scottish First Minister, Alex Salmond, stated repeatedly before the 2014 referendum that it would be a once-in-a-generation opportunity. With hindsight, was that not a hostage-to-fortune statement? And do you think Alex Salmond regrets putting the 2014 referendum in that context?
it may have been a mistake to use that the phrase, but perhaps it's a forgivable mistake. I mean, very few people saw Brexit actually happening, and very few people predicted a scenario whereby the UK would vote by a narrow margin to leave the European Union, whereas 62% of Scots voted to remain in the European Union. So that is why I think that there is a very justifiable case for going for a second referendum much earlier than the generation gap which was referred to in the last campaign.
And the other obstacle potentially is Europe, with some countries there or representatives in Europe saying that Scotland would have to go to the back of the queue, etc. Should the independence movement have done more to garner greater international support for Scottish independence to help counter those kinds of potential obstacles to EU membership?
Well, we're working on that. I remember during the 2014 campaign, José Manuel Barroso said that an independent Scotland was most unlikely to get a membership of the European Union. In fact, I think he used even stronger words to rule it out absolutely. But we've got to remember that José Barroso was not speaking on behalf of all member states. He was president of the European Commission at that time. And Barroso may have been motivated by the fact that he did not want to alienate his Spanish friends, who are worried about the possibility of independence for Catalonia and possibly other regions of Spain. Now, some politicians in other European Union member states take a different line from Barroso, and even Spain may take a different line if Scottish independence is seen to be a reality rather than just a threat. I mean, you've got to bear in mind the importance of Scotland's fishing resources, their energy resources and many other resources, and I think the probability is that those people who resist an independent Scotland joining the European Union, I think they could be won over.
And finally, the UK government is not completely ruling out another Scottish independence referendum, but they are suggesting it would have to be after Brexit is completed. But what are the consequences for Scotland politically, economically, and to the general Scottish psyche if another no vote is returned next time around?
I'm confident that won't happen, but even if there was another no vote, many people, including myself, would continue campaigning for independence. That's what we believe in. But I have to admit that it would be an uphill struggle if there was a no vote this time round. So that's all the more reason why we must work harder than ever to ensure victory this time round. And I am confident, very confident, that we can persuade a majority of the people of Scotland that an independent Scotland will mean a better Scotland, a fairer Scotland, and help to build a better world.
Dennis Canavan, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
Thank you, Mark.
That was Mark Hurst there talking to Dennis Canavan, the former MP, and more recently, of course, the chair of Yes Scotland's advisory board. Yes Scotland being the official campaign for Scottish independence during the 2014 referendum. And Mark will be joining us in the studio in a few minutes to discuss all of this in a bit more detail. But before that, continuing on the theme of the Scottish Government's calls for another referendum on independence from the United Kingdom, Jack Foster has been keeping an eye on this morning's clashes inside the Scottish Parliament.
Less than 3 days since the Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon announced her intention to hold a second referendum on Scotland's independence, and the leader of the Scottish Government took her weekly questions in Parliament. Unsurprisingly, she came under fire for her plans on an independence referendum, firstly from the opposition Scottish Conservative and Unionist parties, Ruth Davidson.
The Scottish Conservatives reject the proposal set out by the First Minister on Monday. A referendum cannot happen when the people of Scotland have not been given the opportunity to see how our new relationship with the European Union is working. And it should not take place when there is no clear political or public consent for it to happen. Our country does not want to go back to the divisions and uncertainty of the last few years. Another referendum campaign will not solve the challenges that this country will face. We don't want it. We don't need it. Why won't she listen?
First Minister.
I was elected as First Minister a year ago with the highest constituency share of the vote in the history of devolution on a manifesto commitment that said this Parliament should have the right to hold another referendum if the Tories tried to drag us out of Europe. against our will. That 46% share of the vote is 10 percentage points higher than the 36% share that the Tories used to have the EU referendum in the first place. And we hear from the Electoral Commission this morning that the vote share they may have got in the 2015 election was rather dodgy. But this Parliament has an independence majority in it as well. So Ruth Davidson says she wants to put this Parliament first. Well, let me issue this direct challenge to Ruth Davidson and to the Conservative Party. If on Wednesday next week this Parliament votes for an independence referendum to give the people of Scotland a choice over their own future, will the Conservatives respect the will of this Parliament, or are the Conservatives running scared?
Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, in an exchange with her opposition number Ruth Davidson of the Scottish Conservative Party, in the Scottish Parliament this morning. And criticisms over the prospect of a second referendum continued from Kezia Dugdale, the leader of the Scottish Parliament's third party, the Labour Party.
The reality is that this government will once again grind to a halt for years. Closing the attainment gap, that's not the priority anymore. Fixing the mess she made of the NHS, on the back burner. Investing in the care of the elderly, well, that can wait too. Can the First Minister tell us this? Does she plan to spend the next few years leading a government or a campaign?
All of these things get more difficult if we are subjected year after year to Tory cuts. Tory cuts that are going to be made worse by the hard Brexit that the Tories are pursuing and Labour seem willing to support. It is absolutely shameful that instead of standing up for Scotland, Labour simply supports the Conservatives and whatever they want to do. I want this country to take charge of our own future so that we can build a better country than Labour and the Tories have managed to do. So when people have a choice, as I am determined that they will have, a choice to say what kind of future they want, I'll be arguing for this country to be in charge of our own finances, in charge of our own future, in charge of building a fairer society and a stronger economy. Kezia Dugdale will be on the side of Ruth Davidson and Theresa May yet again, and her party will continue to die as a result.
Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon facing down questions in the Scottish Parliament this morning over her intention to hold a second referendum on independence from the United Kingdom, from Scottish Labour leader Kezia Dugdale there. The Scottish Parliament in Edinburgh will be holding a vote next week on whether or not to apply to the UK government for permission to hold such a referendum. The maths inside of the Scottish Parliament means that that vote will almost certainly go in Nicola Sturgeon's favour. What happens next, though, when that Section 30 order, as it's known, is formally requested from the UK Prime Minister Theresa May, no friend of Scottish independence, well, that is where things will undoubtedly start to get a lot more interesting. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
And Jack Foster and Mark Kirst join me in the studio now.
I've taken my Dutch politics hat off and put my Scottish politics hat on. You'd be relieved to hear.
Well, there's a bit of a deja vu for many of us, and I don't think that any of us really in 2014 after that referendum would have expected that 3 years later we'd be sitting talking about another referendum. But is...
I think a lot of people in Scotland would have hoped that that would be the case.
Well, yes, 45% of the electorate would have hoped that would be the case. But I don't think the SNP hoped that would be the case. I think this is still a little bit early for them.
I think it was early for them in 2011. I mean, it was quite clear that they never anticipated... No one anticipated any government for being able to command a majority in the Scottish Parliament, and that absolutely compelled the SNP then to bring forward their plans, which emerged ultimately in the 2014 referendum. So they were taken by surprise then, taken by surprise again, probably. I think they were a bit complacent in the run-up to the Brexit vote, although you can't put that purely at their door. It was quite. I spoke to the David Mundell, the Scottish Secretary of State, a week before the Brexit vote, and he was absolutely adamant that they had it in the bag, and clearly they didn't.
Are perhaps the Scottish National Party just destined to always be on the back foot when it comes to the calling of Scottish referendums, if they call this one, and perhaps if they end up calling more in the future? That's obviously a pessimistic view if you support Scottish independence, but it could well happen. There could be further referendums down the line. Is it just the case that they're never going to have the perfect time? There is no such thing as a perfect moment to call such a referendum.
Well, it's become a cliche, but a week is a long time in politics, which was the point I was trying to make, I think, in the package when I thought it was a bit of a hostage to fortune for Alex Salmond and the SNP to make reference to this once-in-a-generation thing, when it's very difficult to know what's going to happen week to week, month to month, or generation to generation.
Well, I mean, obviously we do disagree, as we were discussing during the package, Mark, about this point on the generation thing. I obviously would say that was more of an observation of the obvious during the last referendum, as indeed it is during any referendum, that it would be a once-in-a-generation opportunity. And I know that people are currently in Scotland, opponents of another referendum are saying, oh, well, you know, you said it was once in a generation, and now here we are having another one 3 years later. But we're not. The Scottish Government are merely talking about applying for the permission to hold another referendum. Potentially that could still take years. Mm-hmm. And a definition of a generation being perhaps 7 or 8 years isn't so crazy.
But there does seem to be one other element at play here, which is that we only seem to be talking about referendums. Now, there are alternative ways for Scotland to become an independent country. And if the UK government...
Conventional ways, actually.
Well, if the UK government doesn't allow a referendum, we might have to start... The SNP might have to start looking at how
it's
else
wee
you
stuff,
could...
Carolyn.
Well, this may spark a fresh debate within the SNP. There was quite a lot of controversy when the referendum policy was adopted by the SNP. I remember Alec Neil, former Scottish Government Minister at the time, saying we will end up becoming the only political party in Western Europe that says vote for us and we won't implement our core policy. We'll give you a chance to think again in a referendum. And so it may, if the Conservative government decide to reject calls for a second referendum, or what is more likely, if they agree to one, but after Brexit, that may lead to a fresh discussion within the SNP as to how they take independence forward.
And that's where the other, that's where the other options lie, of course, which is, and again, we were talking about this earlier on today, that potentially it could be done via an election, having to call a fresh election in the Parliament. Or if there were no permission for a legally binding referendum, and this one is more of a long shot, and I suspect that the Scottish Government wouldn't be keen on doing it. But in such an event, the no side, the unionist side, would be likely to boycott such a referendum. Mm-hmm. If, potentially, the yes side, the pro-independence side, were able to get over 50% of the electorate to turn out and vote yes, that would be quite hard for the UK government to ignore.
I think it'd be very hard for them to win in those circumstances for the SNP, because the argument would... I mean, all it takes is for... not only is it an advisory referendum, but you've got the added problem that you could have unionists saying, don't participate in this, it's a waste of money, etc., etc.
SNP vanity project, I think would be the line I can hear.
And so subsequently, you know, it could end up in catastrophic failure, you know, akin to the Darien project or something of that nature. But, you know, I think it'd be financial folly, might be a phrase that Alex Salmond would use to describe it.
Wouldn't be the first in Scottish history for such an event to happen, I suppose.
Well, I would hope that our senior politicians try and learn from the historical mistakes that we've made in the past, which got us to the point we're at the moment.
Politicians learning from mistakes.
But it looks like we probably won't know if the UK government are going to try and ban it for quite some time yet.
We don't know, but I mean, it seems likely. I mean, they've got the perfect argument to say they're too busy with Brexit, and I mean, it's a major
Administrative... Well, the line at the moment is, until we know what the package is with Brexit, then there's no point in discussing it.
Well, we are out of time on this today, but I'm sure we'll be discussing this over the coming weeks. Thank you, Jack and Mark, and stick with me for the next story.
We will.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
And finally for today, Dan Olsen is the owner of the Railtown Cafe in Vancouver, and he apparently woke up on Tuesday morning to find his phone inundated with angry messages from people in Ireland. Now, Mark, Jack, I'm going to show you the picture that he posted. For our listeners, I'll explain this in
this
a second.
This is very exciting.
This is the picture that sparked outrage. Now, I know you both like a pint of Guinness. What
I can
you
understand.
Make of that?
I can understand why he would be angry with that. To be honest with you,
for listeners' sake, I'm more concerned. Why is there a tub of muffins next to it?
Oh, I don't know. But for listeners, there is a
there's
very
no head.
Poorly,
there's no head on it. Basically,
very poorly poured pint of Guinness, and of course, he was using it to try and promote the St. Patrick's Day celebrations. And apparently,
oh, it's a promotional picture.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, right. I thought this was just a badly poured pint.
No,
by
no,
accident.
No. It's a picture he put out to promote the pub's St. Patrick's Day celebrations.
Have you ever seen a picture of Guinness?
Well, exactly.
There's a picture on the glass.
As a Guinness drinker, I'm very particular about how my Guinness is poured, and I don't know. I think there needs to be some disciplinary action there.
If Guinness wants to send us crates of Guinness for this last story, then we'll happily accept.
Just for tomorrow.
Well, that is all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget, you can listen again to this and to previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, and in just a moment we hand over to Washington DC for the Tom Hartman Show. Until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, and from all of the team here at World in Focus.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Black mayor, black chief of police. I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
After decades of Western regime change in the Middle East, a line has been drawn in Syria, though at enormous human cost. On the 6th anniversary of the start of this conflict, I sit down with Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos to survey the wreckage of Western foreign policy and look at the reality of Trump's presidency and his stance towards Syria and the conflict after 4 months in office. Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Catch all the breaking global political and economic news as it happens. Sputnik brings an all-star lineup with expert opinion from some of the biggest names in the news today. Noam Chomsky.
Turkey, U.S. ally, their main goal is to attack the Kurds, the one ground force opposing ISIS. And there have been a kind of a funnel for support of ISIS, not officially, but in practice.
Peter Sunde, co-founder of the Pirate Bay.
We don't have any sort of democratic control over the internet. And I think that we're very naive when we think that the internet itself is intrinsically good. It's not. It's just a very neutral technology that is being used for good things, but more and more being used for evil things.
Icelandic Foreign Minister Gunnar Bragi Sveinsson.
We increased activities in Keflavik Air Base, and that has to do with more activities from the Russian Northern Fleet in the ocean around Iceland, and also, of course, these usual flights of the bombers.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
We're the ones that destroyed the government of Libya. We're the ones that putting in a pipeline dispute that helped destroy the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. We're the ones who invaded Iraq.
Former U.S. Secretary of Defense William Perry.
The hostile relationship between the United States and Russia today is dangerous for both countries, not because either country would actually want to start a military conflict, but because there's always a danger of blundering.
Sputnik talks to the brightest minds in politics and current affairs to find out what's really happening. Tune in.